From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, news analyst Bruce Murphy weighs in on Indian gaming, Sheriff Clark, and the end of Ryan Braun's graffito. Later, the NFL and GE Healthcare work on improving MRI technology.
Specific to traumatic brain injury, it is also a tool that's used, but it's not, I believe, has the resolution or capabilities that's needed today to do a better evaluation of somebody who may be concussed or who's had a traumatic brain injury.
We'll preview the Packers season, which opens this weekend, and the story of the area's newest art museum in Cedarburg.
It is a community museum. Our mission is to support not just the arts in Cedarburg, but it's also to support the Cedarburg community as a place that's vibrant and interesting place to live.
Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next, after the news. Lake Effect Weekend from Milwaukee Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Tyke. Not far from downtown Milwaukee, a high-rise hotel project is underway at the casino operated by the Potawatomi tribe in the Menominee Valley. It's the only such casino in southeastern Wisconsin, but that could change if a plan by the Menominee tribe to build a new casino in Kenosha moves forward. There were developments on that front recently, and our news analyst Bruce Murphy joins us on the line to talk about them, along with some other stories from the past week. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Mitch. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here, as always. There's a major war in the casino world that is heating up in Wisconsin. Late last month, the Federal Department of Interior gave its approval for a proposal to create a casino in Kenosha. But it leaves it up to the governor whether to approve or not approve, and that has led to this escalation. Let's start with the governor himself. Where does Scott Walker fall on this casino issue in Kenosha?
Well, it's worth noting it's only up to the governor. The legislature has no control over this. So he's the one guy who can decide whether this can be approved. And he's basically said, well, I'm not going to play Solomon and pick and choose between two well-respected entities like the Potawatomi and Menominee tribes. And so I want the 11 tribes in Wisconsin to come to an agreement, and then I'll support that decision. And, you know, that sounds very philosophical and even practical, and I'm sure it will play well statewide. But, you know, I think insiders immediately knew that he was, in essence, siding against the Menominee Casino's bid because the tribes compete with each other for customers. They, you know, you have a lot of casinos here, and the proposed Kenosha Casino that the Menominee would run is quite likely to take customers away from the Potawatomi Casino in Milwaukee.
And the Potawatomis hold quite a lot of sway in the tribal world.
They do, and even beyond the tribal world. In fact, it was interesting, the Department of Interior, in announcing their decision, actually mentioned in passing that it was heartening to see how much clout the Potawatomi has in state and local politics. And, I mean, they've spent like $6 million on lawyers and lobbyists since 2001 to try to beat down the Menominee bid. They were very successful in stalling it for more than a decade. And more recently, you know, they spent on campaign contributions for Governor Jim Doyle in his elections, and more recently spent $150,000 to underwrite the National Governors Association bash here in Milwaukee, which was obviously very important to Scott Walker.
There are economic arguments on both sides of this. How do they shake out?
You've got the Potawatomi saying, you know, we could lose as much as, I think they're projecting, $150 million a year, a third of their revenue. And the city of Milwaukee supports that. They say that Potawatomi could lose 3,000 jobs. But, you know, the Department of Interior officials who do oversee Indian tribes and gaming, they estimated that the impact on the Potawatomi would be pretty modest. So there's that whole side of it. And then there's just the whole, should we have a free market in the casino business? State Senator Mike Ellis came out and said, you know, Walker should support the free market here and just let the casinos compete.
Well, for all the good financial fortunes that the Potawatomi have had in recent years, the Menominees have not done as well.
No, it's really, you know, for anyone who has traveled through Menominee County, it's a very beautiful area, but you can kind of sense the poverty there. About 90% of the residents of that county are Menominee Indians. And any time there's statistics on Wisconsin, that county always shows up with by far the highest unemployment, highest poverty, worse health data, whether it's alcoholism, teen pregnancy, premature deaths. So it's really a destitute county, and this casino could really transform the lives of those people, as it, you know, as the Milwaukee Casino actually did earlier for the Potawatomi Indians.
So obviously a lot at stake here. Let's go to back to the governor for a moment and the news late this week that he's canceled a grant from the state to the group United Sportsmen of Wisconsin that has been much in the news of recent days. First of all, what was that grant initially supposed to do?
It's a funny little arcane grant that was going to, quote, introduce youth, women, and others to the state's sporting traditions. In essence, the idea was that some nonprofit group would get funding to teach people about hunting and handling guns, I guess. I mean, some might question whether we need the government to actually pay for something like that.
Beyond that one point, what were the other problems with the legislation as it was written?
You know, Mitch, this is one of those deals where they say you don't want to watch how sausages or legislation are made. I mean, this was a quickie budget amendment that got all of 7 minutes of discussion, got no press coverage. It was clearly intended to hand the grant to this group, United Sportsmen, which has political affiliations. It supported conservative causes, Republican politicians. And the legislation was actually tailored the way it was written so that groups that actually have a long track record in the conservation and outdoor sports field, like, say, the Wisconsin Wildlife Foundation, were not eligible to apply. So, in essence, the grant was never publicized. Only the United Sportsmen group applied for it, and naturally they got it.
And would you make the contention that the United Sportsmen was not an above-board organization?
Well, it's not really me making that contention. I mean, the Journal Sentinel has gone overboard with stories, one after another, raising questions, and it turns out the group is not a nonprofit. It's not registered as such with either the state or the federal government. It's falsely claimed to state officials that it was, and finally, it turned out that its leader was convicted and fined for hunting with the wrong license some years back. I mean, given that the group was supposed to be teaching people how to hunt but has no track record actually doing that, I think this violation was the last straw for Governor Walker.
And so does the Walker administration learn a lesson from this?
I don't really know. I think, you know, there's nothing necessarily new about cronyism and bad lawmaking, which surely this is an example of. But the thing that's surprising to me is that this went on, the news coverage on this went on for more than 2 weeks with ever more revelations before the governor canceled the contract. So he certainly had steely nerves on this, but maybe the lesson is next time he should cut the connection with his group a little sooner.
Speaking of interesting publicity, why did the sheriff of Milwaukee County threaten to arrest the head of the House of Corrections this past week?
Well, that is really a crazy story. So apparently he wanted the new head of the House of Correction, Richard Schmidt, to accept some 70 inmates from the county jail downtown. And when Hafeman declined and said we had no room, Clark's number two man, Richard Schmidt, basically said that we're going to arrest you by order of the sheriff for obstructing a law enforcement officer.
And that's clearly not all that was at work here. There is some background that goes well before this particular scenario.
Yeah, I mean, Clark used to run the House of Corrections. In fact, he even changed its name for a while, and I've forgotten the name. Do you remember it? It was a Southeast something, but I think we've all forgotten it. But it's just one funny thing about this. And so basically both the county executive, the county board, wanted him removed from overseeing the House of Correction, as did many of the judges. So the sheriff no longer has control over the House of Correction, but he's still trying to issue it orders. And Hafeman, the new head of the House of Correction, said, well, actually, I can't take these additional inmates because when Clark ran the House of Correction, he had eliminated funding for air conditioning for one of the dorms, and the temperature at the time was 95 degrees, and they just felt they couldn't take any inmates and put them in there.
Now, your publication, Urban Milwaukee, has reported that, that is not the only aspect to this story. There are also canine units at issue.
Yeah, so it's a shaggy dog story. So one of Clark's last acts before relinquishing control of the House of Correction was to transfer all the canine teams from the house and bring them downtown. Actually, County Executive Chris Abley told Urban Milwaukee that for a while he could hear dogs barking at the courthouse. And Clark had written that the dog teams at the jail and the House of Correction were critical to safety, that they were a critical part of the safety element in terms of handling the inmates. And there had been 12 at the House of Correction and 8 at the county jail downtown, and he took all the 12 from the House of Correction and moved them downtown.
Does this particular set of issues have any more potential political fallout for the sheriff than anything else that has put him in the news recently?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, it should be noted that Clark did back down in all of this. He did. Apparently, he's now moving the canine teams back to the House of Corrections. And, you know, there are some people who, you know, Clark has had a lot of appeal as a law and order Democrat and sort of a character with no-nonsense views. But I guess the question becomes, is there a point where you cross the line from a character to, you know, something more negative, and does that have a factor when you run for election? I wonder whether all this stuff, he's been in the news so many times, whether this starts to add up when he runs for re-election in 2016.
And finally, Surge Restaurant Group announced this week that, first of all, Ryan Braun's Graffito Restaurant is now just called Graffito Restaurant, and by the end of the year, it will not be a restaurant at all. Obviously, fallout from Ryan Braun's admission and apology involving performance-enhancing drugs continues. This can't be good for the restaurant group.
Well, it certainly isn't. The Surge Restaurant Group has actually been a group that celebrities have been a big part of their appeal. Their restaurant Carnivore has always attracted pro sports stars. That's part of the ambience. And so this Third Ward restaurant, Ryan Braun's Graffito, it was all built around his name. It pretty much rose and fell with his fortune. So this is, you know, obviously bad news for them that they're going to have to close the restaurant.
They have another restaurant already open and one under development that combine the celebrity of Ryan Braun and Aaron Rodgers. What do we know about the 812 restaurants?
Yeah, so the 812, that's for each of their sports numbers. And there was one in Brookfield and another one planned for Bayshore. And I think part of the appeal was, you know, there was a friendship between these two guys, perhaps the two biggest sports stars in the state. Well, you know, now you've had Rodgers distancing himself from Braun, and, you know, the owners are going to have to change the name, change the promotions. So at the very least, it's a lot of marketing money down the drain.
And speaking of marketing money, there are other companies that had associations with Ryan Braun who have ended those associations.
Yeah, so the Wilson Sporting Goods dropped Braun as a spokesperson, and so did the Quick Trip convenience store chain.
Did the Brewers also have to look at changing their promotions? Obviously, it hasn't been an easy year to promote anything if you're the Brewers.
No, it's a dreadful year. I mean, obviously, they have a lot of money wrapped up in Braun, not just in terms of his contract, but in terms of the team's identity and how it's been promoted. And so there are just a lot of reverberations here. I mean, sports is really big business, and it's a really big American business, and you can really see this playing out here.
Perhaps the solution is next year Bruce Murphy or Mitch Tyke bobblehead night.
I like it. I like the idea.
Bruce, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bruce Murphy is editor at the news and opinion website UrbanMilwaukee.com and our regular Lake Effect Weekend news analyst. As the NFL season opens, the league is partnering with a Wisconsin company to try to better diagnose brain injuries. We'll learn about that partnership when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Like Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The Green Bay Packers season begins with a Sunday afternoon struggle against the San Francisco 49ers, but the struggle is a different one for players who have sustained head injuries. The National Football League last week settled a lawsuit with former players who sustained brain injuries during their careers, but another group of four players filed a new lawsuit this week claiming the league and a helmet manufacturer hid the true dangers of brain injury. The NFL points to proactive measures it says it is taking to protect players today. One of those is a partnership, the Head Health Initiative, with the Milwaukee area's GE Healthcare. It provides funding for developing the next generation of MRI devices, which could make diagnosing brain injuries easier. Baldev Aluwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
What is the ultimate aim of this partnership that the GE has entered into with the NFL?
Well, Mitch, it has multiple goals. The first goal is to improve our understanding and education of traumatic brain injury and make sure we can better understand how it's diagnosed and what the prognosis would be. The second one is to understand what technologies could be better used to better detect traumatic brain injury. And the third one is product development, taking our understanding and learning from both clinical research and development and product development and apply that into products and make it available in the marketplace.
Where does the technology currently stand? What's the weak point that you're seeking to address that can make things better?
It's a very interesting question. You know, MR is an incredibly sensitive tool today. It is probably one of the most sensitive tools to evaluate and look at the brain. It is also one of the later stages or tools used in the diagnosis or determine what treatment should be used for a patient. And in specific to traumatic brain injury, it is also a tool that's used, but it's not, I believe, has the resolution or capabilities that's needed today to do a better evaluation of somebody who may be concussed or who've had a traumatic brain injury.
Well, and let's take a step even further back than that. We talk about MRI. It stands for magnetic resonance imaging. But what exactly is it? In a nutshell, how does it work?
Well, an MRI, as you said, magnetic resonance imaging, uses a very strong magnetic field and radio waves to look at really the distribution of water in the tissue, how the water or protons specifically is bound to different types of tissue, white matter, gray matter, fat, cerebral spinal fluid in your blood, and look how that changes over different parameters. So they're typically in an MRI exam when you may go in the brain, a physician will maybe prescribe five or six different ways of looking at the brain. And they'll use those five or six different methods of looking at the brain to put together a puzzle to determine what the issue may be. Sometimes they'll do an acquisition which is very sensitive to blood, sometimes an acquisition which is very sensitive to white matter or gray matter in the brain. And they'll compose a picture to determine what the diagnosis would be.
So when you're talking about being able to improve the resolution in order to achieve stronger results, what are we able to see today and what might we be able to see given this partnership and further developments in the field?
Well, today we can see many impressive things. We can see stroke incredibly well. We can see how the brain is perfused with blood very well. We can see anatomical changes well. But what we don't understand clearly is all the things that may change specifically with concussion, what's the rate of change, and how sensitive does the device need to be so that we can accurately monitor that change over time. In preparation for this meeting, you highlighted functional magnetic resonance imaging. And that is a very exquisite tool and a very sensitive tool for looking at changes and minute changes in blood flow based on, activation of areas parts of the brain. That is one tool today that we will be advancing to improve the diagnostic or prognostic capabilities of an MRI scanner to evaluate traumatic brain injury. The other ones are, things like microbleeds. Depending upon the level of impact or the type of concussion, you can have very small microbleeds. It is felt, I should say, that there can be small microbleeds based upon the severity of the concussion. And if there are microbleeds, it may take you longer to recover. We had a medical advisory board in May of this year, and the medical advisory board was made up of people from the NCAA, the NFL medical advisories, the Department of Defense, good partners of General Electric. And what it is product development is a team sport. And this is not something that we can do alone. We need really good partners and partners across multiple facets. One of those critical goals, as at the beginning, is understand and improve our understanding and education of how MR may be applied to evaluate and improve traumatic brain injury. And that's the part of the medical advisory board. They're collaborators with us, and they help us understand where else we should look and improve the capabilities of the scanner to then migrate what should go into product and why.
we think about the number of people, I mean, the very high-profile people who are dealing with traumatic brain injury are often NFL players, other sports as well. Is one of the roles that the NFL is going to be playing in this partnership, are they providing you with athletes who are in need of this kind of diagnosis?
No, they're not providing athletes in need of the diagnosis. That is specifically – the responsibility of the research and development is General Electric. It's a partnership with the NFL to help us understand what might be best applied in their realm. But the goals here is not specific to the NFL. The goal for General Electric is to improve the capabilities for anybody who may need the technology, whether that be, you know, my son when he's out riding his bike, or an accident, a car accident on the playing field, the Department of Defense. It's very much a very broad spectrum. It's not a focused solution that we're looking for.
How much of what needs to be done is technology that may already exist in its infancy and needs the funding to scale up? And how much of this is about technology that does not even exist yet?
It's a bit of both. There is technology that we have today in-house. Coming from a research and development background, technology only has a benefit when you put it in the hands of a clinician. It's one thing to have it running as a prototype at an evaluation site, but it only has the significant positive impact when you move it to the hands of a clinician and they get to use it every day or in the cases that they have. So there's technology that we have today that I believe can have an important factor in improving the ability to diagnose and prognose traumatic brain injury. There's other ones we don't know yet. So one of the great parts of my role is that I get to work with some incredibly smart people and develop impressive tools. As I said, this is a team sport, and there's a lot of things we don't know. But I think there are things that in the MRI scanner today that can improve our capabilities or a physician's capabilities of diagnosing traumatic brain injury. If you go for a routine neurologic MRI exam today, it is not optimized to evaluate. I don't believe, I should say, it's optimized to evaluate traumatic brain injury. I think there's a lot of things that we need to do to improve those capabilities and the sensitivity of the device to what we expect may be changing in the brain.
If your child was injured, had a head injury, how confident would you be that the MRI that they get when they're taken to the doctor the next day is able to detect the severity of what's wrong with them?
I think it's also why you have tertiary care centers and more outpatient facilities. You know, in those situations, you want to take them to the best facility that is available to you and trust the physicians that you have. And I would trust that they have the capabilities, and they would have the capabilities to understand what best to do.
Is the objective to have equipment then that could exist at any given football stadium or in many, many, many more hospitals so that an athlete who is injured or whoever who is injured has access to this, or is this still going to be the kind of thing that will exist primarily at say trauma centers?
No, I think this is key technology that will become available to a broad spectrum of facilities. And when I say facilities, I mean healthcare providers. And it's not going to be solely to trauma centers because the follow-up from traumatic brain injury is not necessarily days or weeks. It is years in some situations. And the technology is available, I believe, from an evaluation standpoint, from a long-term chronic management of traumatic brain injury, that it can be done at a more outpatient facility. It's the continual evaluation and understanding of the changes over time that MR does not do incredibly well today, or we don't use those tools well today. MR is traditionally a very qualitative exam, and it's moving relatively rapidly towards a quantitative tool.
The NFL has another simultaneous partnership going with the equipment manufacturer Under Armour to look at improving safety through equipment. Is there any overlap in the Venn diagram, if you will? Is there a connection between what they're doing with equipment and what you are doing with diagnosis and treatment?
We are partners, and the partners with Under Armour and partners with the NFL, a lot of that information is very easily and quickly shared. So if somebody comes out with a brand new type of mouth guard that they suspect or believe will reduce the severity of a concussion, it may not have a play in what we do, but getting that to market is a critical thing.
This is a huge deal in professional sports and amateur sports today, in military settings. Is it an exciting challenge to be taking on?
It's a very exciting challenge, and it's also really important for trauma. You know, trauma is probably the biggest cause of traumatic brain injury globally. And when in the United States, it's anything on wheels or anything associated with wheels. It's very exciting. Anytime I talk to the team or any friend or colleague about what we're doing with traumatic brain injury, they all say, I know somebody, or it's affected me this way personally. So emotionally, it's very strong. With that emotion comes high motivation. And if the rate of change is so great, then all the better.
This is a partnership with many different stakeholders, but what do you see the NFL doing in the context of this partnership?
In the context of the partnership, well, primarily we have common goals in this partnership. The primary role is funding. You know, it's a joint development. GE is putting in $30 million. The NFL is putting in $30 million. And that $30 million goes to three things. One is challenge grants to quickly migrate technology that's in the hands of anybody who has intellectual property and move that into the marketplace or advance it so that it could potentially be better evaluated. Completing research and development. So there's $10 million to clinical research and development to determine what should go into GE MRI products. And the last component is MRI product development in itself, which is $30 million. So the NFL's goals and GE goals in this joint development are common, and their responsibility is financial, which is equal in partnership with GE as well.
Are you anticipating – obviously things are early on in this partnership, but are you going to work with team physicians, say, and just talk to them about the kinds of challenges that they have? I mean, where are they going to be involved in any part of this, or is this essentially going to be a finished product by the time it gets to a football setting?
So there's a couple things. One is that we've actually worked very closely with University of Purdue. They have done a lot of work with high school players, and they work very closely with the athletic trainers who are on the sidelines, who are seeing the issues on a day-to-day basis and understanding how best to treat the patient. And they're also at the same time using MR to evaluate how the athlete, student-athlete, is progressing after the concussion. Are we working with team physicians? We're working with the NFL physicians. So there's team physicians, but predominantly the NFL has a consultant group of three or four physicians. Specifically, we are working with the Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, and they are part of the Medical Advisory Board to make sure that we are fully aware of the research that is going on, as well as how the NFL is managing players today. And the NFL Players Association is engaged with that closely.
Baldev Ahluwalia, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Baldev Ahluwalia is the premium segment manager in MRI for GE Healthcare. The Milwaukee area company is partnering with the NFL to develop new MRI technology through the NFL's Head Health Initiative. Another break now, and after halftime, we'll focus on the action on the gridiron itself and look ahead to football season with sports contributor Howie Magner. This is Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Weekend now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The NFL season officially got underway on Thursday night, but for most Wisconsinites, it is the Packers Sunday kickoff that really marks the start to the season. Sports contributor Howie Magner joins us to look ahead to the next 16 games at least. Howie, great to see you.
Good to see you, Mitch Tyke. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, and I suspect a lot of people are doing pretty well, what with the start of football season this weekend. I want to start with how training camp ended for the Packers, and that was with kind of a quarterback controversy, but not one involving Aaron Rodgers, rather involving the second-string quarterback, which went from being Graham Harrell to being Vince Young to being B.J. Coleman to being none of the above. What was going on there?
Yeah, I guess if you're going to have a quarterback controversy, you want it to involve your backups and not your starting quarterback. I think everybody realizes that Aaron Rodgers is the Packers. The Packers are Aaron Rodgers. The Packers will do as well as Aaron Rodgers does. And as long as he's on the field, you can make the argument that they have the best quarterback in the league and therefore one of the best offenses in the league. So when you've got such certainty there, sometimes you kind of go looking elsewhere to see, okay, where are some of the weaknesses of this team? And the backup quarterback position is certainly one of those. And so, you know, they brought in Vince Young off the street, kind of in the middle of training camp, to provide some competition for Graham Harrell, who had been with the franchise, as well as B.J. Coleman. And by the end of training camp, not a one of them was still on the roster. So apparently the Packers didn't think that any of those guys were capable backing up Aaron Rodgers.
Right. They cut Graham Harrell and everybody said, oh, well, Vince Young has won this competition.
Right.
Then they cut Vince Young and they said, oh, they must see something in B.J. Coleman. And then B.J. Coleman was gone.
Exactly. So whatever they saw in all of those guys, it wasn't enough. And so they were kind of left scrambling. And that's not necessarily unusual at the end of training camp. A lot of guys get cut and maybe some guy gets cut out there that you think would be a better fit for your system. And so the Packers ended up settling on Seneca Wallace, who had been spending some time in the San Francisco 49ers camp. And they also ended up signing Scott Tolzien, the former Wisconsin Badger, to the practice squad. So, and he had spent time with the San Francisco 49ers. So it really was kind of an interesting subplot to the whole Packers training camp, but that's all it was, really, was a subplot, because once the season starts, people aren't going to be paying a whole lot of attention to the guy who's carrying the clipboard on the sidelines. They're going to be paying attention to Aaron Rodgers, and the things that folks will be complaining about is, did Rodgers hold the ball too long? Why didn't he see that open receiver? Things of that nature.
The Packers looked pretty mediocre during the preseason. Mm-hmm. Were there any concerns for you as you saw the Packers play in the preseason?
It's always hard to kind of get a gauge on how a team is doing in the preseason anyway, because you don't really know how much they're putting out there from an effort standpoint, from a playbook standpoint, things of that nature. With the Packers, it was even more difficult than usual, because not only was that the case, but Aaron Rodgers wasn't really playing any more than one series or two series in every preseason game. The other thing was they really didn't have a lot of their weapons even when the first-teamers were on the field. Jordy Nelson missed the entire preseason. Basically, he played, I think, one series in the final preseason game with a knee injury. He's healthy now and will be playing in the opener. Randall Cobb also missed much of the preseason with an injury. And, you know, you expect he will be healthy and a big part of the offense this year. So I don't know that you necessarily got a realistic picture of what the offense can do. We'll certainly see a different, you know, we'll find out if it was a mirage going forward, because everybody will be healthy and they'll be playing regular minutes in the regular season. And you would assume that the Packers will be, you know, every bit as good, if not better than last year. And one of the big reasons for that is because people like the upgrade that they made to their running game in drafting Eddie Lacy, the rookie running back, who folks expect he's going to provide a dimension of this team that they haven't seen for a few years. The biggest question mark for my money with the offense going into the season is the offensive line. Will they be able to protect the Packers, franchise quarterback in Aaron Rodgers? And Brian Bulaga, who is going to be the starting left tackle, is gone for the season with a knee injury. So ever since that happened, they've kind of been mixing and matching and hoping that some guys who were expected to be backups can perform in starters roles. So it's going to be kind of a trial by fire for that offensive line, and they're protecting the franchise's most important asset. The most impressive thing I thought from the Packers from a preseason standpoint was how well the defense played. The Packers didn't score very many points offensively during the preseason, but they also didn't give up many either. And that was their big weakness, not only last year, but the last few years. They're getting some players back healthy. Perry, their first-round draft pick last year, is healthy this year. They're hoping he'll provide a bit of more of a pass rush complement to Clay Matthews. So it will be really interesting to see if the defense has finally turned a corner. And if that's the case, if the defense can perform, you know, at a level almost as high as the Packers offense, then they're going to be a really scary team.
There is an obvious parallel to be drawn with the Brewers right now, because the team that is on the field at Miller Park feels a little bit like spring training part two. And the Brewers have been out of contention really for all intents and purposes for a long time.
Basically since May.
So let's talk about this group of guys that is playing as the Brewers. Is there's some use to the Brewers actually getting an extended look at their future playing in the major leagues today?
Yeah, I mean, once you realize that the season is a lost season, then you've got to kind of start looking elsewhere to make the season somewhat valuable in certain ways. And one of the ways you do that is you look at your younger players and you see what you've got. And they've certainly done that with young players like Chris Davis, who stepped into an outfield role after Ryan Ryan Braun accepted his suspension. And, you know, without Braun in the picture, they got a chance to see, you know, Chris Davis. And you know, he actually performed pretty well. And then you're looking at a young guy like Scooter Gennett, who got a chance to come up when Ricky Weeks was lost for a season-ending injury. And Scooter Gennett has performed quite well when he got his opportunity. So those guys may have played their way into the picture when it comes to next season. And had this not been a lost season, had they been contenders and, you know, everybody had stayed healthy and stayed on the field, then you wouldn't have seen what those guys are really capable of doing at the major league level.
Well, and speaking of guys that have shown something this year, the New York Times about a week and a half ago made the case that even though it probably won't happen, Carlos Gomez might be able to lay claim to some votes anyway for National League MVP. What has Carlos Gomez shown this year?
Well, he's really been one of the team's biggest surprises, and you could say one of the league's biggest surprises, because coming into the season, I think everybody knew that Carlos Gomez was one of the best, if not the best, defensive center fielders in all of baseball. So he had that going for him, and that's really one of the big reasons, probably the main reason, why the Brewers agreed to give him a contract extension before the season started. Well, he came in, he had the comfort of the new contract. He knew that he was going to be an everyday starter in center field, and that really seemed to help his offensive game. And he came out and is among the league leaders, if not the team leader in home runs on this team as well. And, you know, here was a guy who you weren't even sure if you wanted him in the upper half of the order. And he became one of the biggest run producers in your lineup, and they were batting him third at some points during the season, which you never would have thought last year. So he really grew particularly at the offensive portion of his game. And I think when you combine that with how good he is defensively, that's where you're getting a lot of the push for most valuable player. Now, he's not going to win it. And frankly, he probably isn't going to finish very high in the voting. And the reason being is that voters typically don't value defense that much when they're thinking of these types of things. So his offensive numbers aren't going to compare to some of the guys who are out there hitting 40 home runs and driving in 100 runs. But when you look at Gomez as an entire package, as an offensive player, a guy who hits for some power, a guy who has raised his batting average pretty significantly this season, a guy who, when he gets on base, is always a threat to steal, and then you add in the defensive aspect of that, you've really got a guy playing at a premium defensive position who brings a lot to the table. And even if he doesn't get consideration for the most valuable player, the Brewers won't mind. They know they've found somebody who's going to be a key piece of their lineup for years going forward. And I think they thought he was going to be a nice player, and certainly defensively. I don't think they expected him to have this much effect offensively. And now he's here, and you hope that he can continue it going down the road.
And finally today, we have never talked about mixed martial arts on this show with you before. So why are we taking a minute today to talk about the world championship won by a man named Anthony Pettis? Why should we care?
You should care because here is a Milwaukee-born guy who has a heck of a backstory. His father was murdered when Anthony was a young boy. He basically dedicated his life to mixed martial arts, hooked up with a gentleman by the name of Duke Rufus, who was a world champion kickboxer, also out of Milwaukee. And basically, Anthony Pettis climbed the ranks, and now he is considered one of the best fighters in the UFC in the world. And he won the UFC lightweight championship right here in his hometown over the weekend at the BMO Harris Bradley Center. And it really was a special moment if you were there in the crowd, not only because of the atmosphere and the place was going crazy. He won in the first round. He submitted his opponent, Benson Henderson, with a move called an arm bar. It was the aftermath that really got to me, just watching the joy on Pettis' face, knowing the journey that it took to get to the top of the heap, all the hard work, all the heartache. He's really been beset by injuries. But the moment that really stuck with me was when he exited the cage, and there was his mom waiting for him. And they just had this long embrace, and there's Pettis basically sobbing in her arms, tears of joy certainly, no doubt thinking about his father. But it was just a really special moment. And then another one happened after the lights had gone out. Pettis had his new championship belt. He went to his father's grave, placed the belt above his father's grave, took a picture of it, and showed it to the world. And it really was just a very special moment, and you have to be happy for a man like that to reach the pinnacle of his profession after he's gone through so much.
One of the reasons we like sports.
Absolutely.
Howie, thanks.
Thank you.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website and is senior editor for the magazine and our regular sports contributor. One last break on Lake Effect Weekend and then the unique story of the area's newest art museum. Keep listening. We'll be back in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The city of Cedarburg is known for its strong local art scene. For example, it hosts one of the largest outdoor plein air painting festivals in the state, and it's getting a new fine arts museum, the Cedarburg Art Museum. Ironically, though, this new community institution opens only because another one closed. When the much-loved Ozaukee Bank was sold to BMO Harris Bank, the directors wanted to give the community a not-so-little parting gift. Director Jill Hepburn tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce the museum's unusual origins fit in with the former bank's mission.
Ozaukee Bank was one of the leading small banks in the state and is definitely the dominant bank in Ozaukee County. And they played the role of a traditional community bank in sort of that old It's a Wonderful Life tradition in that they were a part of the community and they knew everybody. You could come in and everybody said hi and they knew your name. And they really felt like that. And it was a place where people actually got out of their cars and went into the bank because they always knew the tellers and the people knew their faces. And it was just a part of the community. But beyond that, as part of their marketing strategy, they used contributions to community organizations as ways to get their name out and to build that support from the community and get people to come into the bank and be a bank by saying, well, we'll support you and then come in and be a part of our banking operation because we are a part of the community.
Why did they want to continue that giving back to the community even when the bank was being sold to BMO Harris?
Well, I think it was because it was the essence of who they were as a bank. It's sort of interesting to watch as the bank was being sold. It was almost like the community was mourning the loss of this bank because it was so integrated into the community. The people that worked there loved to work there. The people who banked there loved to bank there. And I think the directors felt that they really felt that deeply, and that is who they were. And so they felt it was appropriate to give back to the community because the community have given so much to them also.
Now, giving back is one thing. Creating an entire art museum is another. Tell us how the foundation that the bank created came to this idea of creating a fine arts museum.
The first part of the story is the directors put aside some money in a foundation called the Gift to the Future Fund. That was to support the organizations that they had always supported. The directors knew that by being bought by a larger bank, the chances of the community support in the same way would not – it just wouldn't be the same. So they wanted to make sure that some of those organizations continued to get funding. So they created this foundation that would support the Cultural Center, River Edge Nature Center, some of the other organizations. But the founder of the bank had always collected art for the walls of the bank, and the bank, you know, every office had beautiful local artworks on its walls. And so the idea was to then embrace the idea as Cedarburg as a arts community and take some of those artworks, 49, and donate them to this foundation with the idea that they would eventually be the basis of an art museum in Cedarburg.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, the bank president and the art collector is your husband.
That is true.
So tell me about the development of the Cedarburg Art Museum. These 49 works of art are on display where?
So it just so happens a friend and I were having lunch in a little cafe downtown Cedarburg, and we noticed that that one of the historic buildings downtown was for sale, and we wanted to just take a peek. So we walked across the street and peeked in the windows. And then I went to and we just saw what a beautiful building, how intact it was. It's just a charming building. And immediately it came to mind that this was a place for the art museum. And it wasn't – the art museum was something that was an idea that could happen whenever and not necessarily at this point in time. And I wasn't necessarily going to be involved in it. But it just was like serendipity, and it made sense. So we went to the I went to the foundation, and I said, I think I found the place for the art museum. And then that set everything in motion. The directors agreed, and the community really agreed. Once we got up and running and people have come into the museum, everybody said, oh, I've always wanted to go into this building. But it was never in – it was a real estate office. So you, unless you had business there, you didn't feel like you could just walk in the door. So once that happened, then the next part was just to – because no advanced planning was done for the museum except for, well, we have these artworks. Then, and now we have a building, and now let's create the structure of an art museum. And that's where the community really rallied around the project.
I mean, how do you do that? How do you create a museum out of whole cloth? I mean, most of the time you have the building and then you fill it with works. In this case, you had the opposite. You had the works first and needed to find the building and then create this institution.
Definitely, you would typically do it the other way around, or there'd be more advanced planning, that there'd be, you know, more thought in it. So basically, the building was bought at the end of 2012, and we put a blurb in the newspaper in January of 2013, and people came to the door and said, I want to volunteer. And I have people from all walks of life who have experience in all the different areas that I needed help with. It was sort of, you know, it's, you know, not to sound hokey, but sort of magical in the way that I needed people who understood how to put an exhibit on, and those people showed up, and I needed people to design a logo for me, and that person showed up, and then I have someone who has put together our gift shop for us. It was really, really interesting how that unfolded, and people were new to the community coming to the door and saying, well, I heard about this new thing. I want to be involved. I want to meet some new people. And it's really been really inspirational. And when those nights when I'm working way too many hours, it really has kept me going, having all of those people just toiling away with the idea that we were creating something new and exciting in Cedarburg.
This is really a community institution.
Oh, absolutely. We are 100% volunteer. Ultimately, if you look at it, the foundation was given to us by the community, because that money that the directors were able to put aside was money that was earned from the community. So in all senses of the word, it is a community museum, and it continues to be as we move forward. And we will. Our mission is to support not just the arts in Cedarburg and not just to create a permanent collection and permanent record of Cedarburg's art scene, but it's also to support the Cedarburg community as a community and as a place that's vibrant and interesting place to live.
What's next for the museum?
We're open, and we're having a grand opening this Sunday, just an ice cream social to say, hey, come look at us, and we want to thank you, and we want to just share our excitement about the museum. Going forward, we have our exhibits committee is working on coming up with some really fun and interesting exhibits. Through November, we'll have artworks from the Ozaki Bank collection on exhibit, except for in one room we will have an exhibit by plein air painter Shelby Keefe, who won the very first plein air competition that Cedarburg had. She was the first winner, and the Art Museum has every year's winner for the last 13 years, which is pretty – it's a beautiful collection and just a fun piece of history for Cedarburg. But she has an exhibit this month, and she actually this month just happens to be on the cover of Plein Air magazine, a national magazine. So serendipity came to our aid. In December, we will have a Cedarburg Christmas card collection, both historic Christmas cards and Christmas cards created currently by working artists in a celebration of Christmas and of art and about, and again, that word community. It'll be really fun. And it's with having the historic building, it's really fun to have that juxtaposition of the old and the new together in the building. Starting in February, we're going to have an Edmund Schiltnick exhibit. He was a plein air painter in the 1920s and came through Cedarburg and did some paintings. So there's 11 of his paintings, and they're beautiful and really quintessential Cedarburg. Then going forward, we have a number of exhibits going beyond that. And our big exhibit that we're working towards is a Bernard Schneider exhibit in fall of 2014. And he was one of the nation's premier panoramic painters, but he also painted in Cedarburg. There was a little place called Hilgen Springs where painters and people who wanted to enjoy the summer would come and party and paint and all that sort of good stuff. And he painted in Cedarburg along with some other artists. So we have some images from Cedarburg and Milwaukee that he painted at the turn of the last century. Now, there he was painting in Cedarburg at the same time that our building was built. So there's a chance that perhaps he was even in our building. So that's sort of a fun connection. And that'll be a really interesting and of regional importance exhibit we're looking forward to.
Well, Jill Hepburn, we're going to have you on again in the future to tell us more about what's happening at the Cedarburg Art Museum.
I would love to share more with you. Thank you.
Jill Hepburn is the director of the new Cedarburg Art Museum. Its grand opening ice cream social is Sunday. You can find more information about the event and the museum's upcoming exhibits at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Well, that is all for today's show, and I'm so glad we could be a part of your weekend plans. I'm Mitch Teich. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3. Our weekday edition airs Monday through Friday at 10 each morning. Hope you'll join us again soon for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming your way next.